Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992, knee-deep here in water, fly fishing with Tom Skerritt in 2023. I am your host, Phyllis Govan, with me today, back again, thank God she's here, writer-director Jessica Ellis, to talk with me about A River Runs Through It, a movie that I've never seen, nor I believe you had seen.
No.
Jessica. But like also a movie that I was sort of like felt like I had seen. You thought you actually thought it was Legends of the Fall, if I'm not mistaken.
I thought it was Legends of the Fall. And I mentioned to my writing partner that I was watching it. And he was like, I thought that was Prince of Tides. So,
which I mean, that does have a water theme to it. So I guess there's something to be said to that. Yeah, this was a movie that like so I'm curious where you land on Robert Redford as a director, because I feel like that's a thing unto itself.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like it's really interesting because I feel like, and for our listeners, I'm just going to walk you through his directing credits. Notoriously, first thing he ever directs is Ordinary People. He wins Best Director. It wins Best Picture. It is this sort of widely acclaimed, beloved kind of, I don't know, rich white people problems type movie. That really struck a chord in the 80s or 1980, that is. And he never really recaptures the same level of esteem as a director as he did kind of right at the gate. I think Quiz Show's a straight up masterpiece, but I do feel like that movie kind of weirdly doesn't exist.
Quiz Show is tough for me. I really wanted to love that movie. I loved everything in it, and I had some of the similar problems that I have with this, which is I think pacing is not his strong suit, and it's very, very slow.
He does Ordinary People in 1980. He does the Milagro Beanfield War.
I love that movie. That is my favorite Redford movie.
I've never seen that film.
Oh, you gotta see it.
I should watch it. Then he does this in 92. He does Quiz Show in 94, Horse Whisperer in 98, which was a hit.
Yep.
He whispered to horses with Kristen Scott Thomas and a very young Scarlett Johansson. And then he does Legend of Bagger Vance, a movie that everyone loves. No, it's again, super boring movie.
Yeah.
Then he does Lions for Lambs, which straight up doesn't exist, which is a movie that stars him, Meryl Streep, and Tom Cruise. And it doesn't exist.
I don't think I've ever even heard of it. I don't know how that's possible.
Right? It came out in 07. Cruise is sort of a supporting role as this kind of like right-wingy senator. It was sort of like an Oscar Beatty type thing.
Sure.
But like it just made literally no impact. Because in 07, you had like There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men,
right,
and Michael Clayton. And like these movies just blew everything out of the water. He has a film called The Conspirator, which came out in 2010, which I don't know what that is. And then a movie called The Company You Keep in 2012, which I have a vague recollection of existing. But all of this is to say that Robert Redford as director is sort of, he was kind of the first, I don't want to say the first guy today, because I mean, I guess that's really Orson Welles, but like an actor that gets best director, that gets best picture, that kind of everybody sort of gives the flowers to and kind of paves the way for your Kevin Costner's and
sure.
Mel Gibson's, for what that's worth.
Thanks a lot, Robert.
Thanks, Bobby. So yeah, I, the reason I bring this up is you mentioned it sort of very astutely. He does have a vision and a style.
Yes.
But it's kind of snoozy.
Very. This was, I'm not going to denigrate the movie too much because I think sure. it has a beautiful theme, but this was probably the most boring movie I've ever watched in my entire life. It is, and like, it, you know, it was made in the 90s, and you and I talked about this on text in a little bit. It was when dads were king, and white dads were king, and like, it just, I just watching it now in 23, I was like, did these people ever encounter a real problem in their entire lives? Like, it is the most minimal white guy shit. It's just unbelievable. While saying that, it's beautiful and there's very profound moments in it. But like, oh my God, is this a slow, slow movie, especially if you do not care about fishing in any way, shape or form, which I do not.
Which is fair. I mean, so Norman MacLean wrote this semi-autobiographical story collection, essentially. And it was largely kind of rejected by most publishers. Apparently, including one that rejected it on the basis that it contained, quote unquote, too many trees, which is amazing. Which, I mean, respect. It was eventually published by the University of Chicago Press in 76, and it went on to sell like a staggering amount of copies. Like, it was a very successful collection. Redford chased him for years. This feels like the type of white people shit that existed,
man, in the like, white man shit. Let's be specific.
Sure. Yes. Where you had sort of your late '70s, early '80s, it was a different world back then, right? Yes. And a story like this, I can understand hitting a vein in a way that it just quite simply would not do today.
Yeah.
And I think that as I'm watching this, and it should also be said, Redford narrates the film.
Boy, does he, in every scene.
Well, I mean, he doesn't narrate that much, but he narrates a handful of this film. And the narration is directly pulled from this. From this story.
Yeah.
There is something kind of comforting and warm about Redford's narration. And in the sense that, like, there's this kind of harmony that exists between my notions of Robert Redford as a human, of which I have very little, truly. Like, from what I've read about him, he seems like a good guy for the most part.
Sure.
You know, obviously you have the Sundance Film Festival, which ultimately will sort of probably be one of his biggest legacies when everything is said and done. I respect his politics. I respect his artistic expression and the support of young artists and artists in general and independent cinema, all that kind of stuff. So there's kind of this almost kind of dad, grandfather energy that he has in my brain already. Mm-hmm. And then with that narration, sort of kind of hugs the whole film in a way. But all of this is to say, to underline what you're saying, hard to really lock into this movie, like hard to really care about these people.
Well, I think he made kind of a classic adaptation mistake, which was that he was so in love with the written version of this story that he forgot to make it into a movie. Like, a lot of the narration in it, it's like, boy, it would be interesting to see that dramatized, like on the screen that we're watching, as opposed to being just told it. And it, so much of the movie is like, I guess there could be conflict here, but there's really not and you know, he brings in all of these beautiful prose words and stuff. And it reminds me, there was a similar thing done in Seabiscuit, which actually I think did it more successfully because it was, the narration was used as a way to establish the time and the era. And this film sort of starts that way with talking about Montana at this time and the town that the boys grew up in. But then it just becomes a monologue in many of the scenes about what the character is thinking or what is going on. And it's like, this is a visual medium. I should be seeing that. That should be visual.
I absolutely agree with you. I think that it's, it's clear he loves this story.
Very right? much.
And he has projected a lot of stuff onto this story.
Yes.
But to sort of piggyback on what you're saying, my biggest issue with this movie is that fundamentally, I don't know what makes Norman and Paul tick.
Not at all.
Like, I don't know what actually drives them as humans. What they desire. I know that Norm likes Jesse. Great.
Sure. For some cool. reason.
Correct. Unclear. I mean, she seems to be kind of as close to a like whippersnapper as you can be in this universe. But yes, I agree with you. Whatever. Paul is kind of a big question mark. And the impression that I'm getting is that I don't know that Norman really knew his brother all that well.
Right.
I think that he's a bit of a mystery to him to begin with. I don't think the story really illuminates a ton about him. And so what we're kind of given is this cipher in the form of a very cute Brad Pitt. I mean, hard not to think he's charismatic.
Very charismatic. Yeah.
But he's also very green at this point too.
Like, you know, I prefer him like this because he feels really? Like he was trying. He feels like he was trying. I feel like since about 1998, Brad Pitt has been being Brad Pitt in every movie that he's in, and he's never really done a character. In this, I feel like I actually see him acting, which with him is nice because I feel like he's not just showing up and being Brad Pitt on screen. He's trying to inhabit a character, and I find that much more admirable, you know, and of a pursuit for an actor.
We're going to put a pin in that.
All right, we'll come back to that.
We'll come all back right. to that. But to this sort of this notion of these two main characters, first of all, I mean, Craig Sheffer, sure. I mean, it's you can't hang a movie on this guy. And I know that sounds shitty, but it's just really tough when A, I don't really know much about this character, and B, he's just not giving me what I need in terms of just, you know.
Yeah, I don't want to blame the actor too much for this, though, because I feel like it's the writing and the directing here, because it's like, yeah. You can have, you know, it seems like what the story, if you wanted to make the story really dramatic, it would be about a prodigal son narrative between the stiff older brother who tries to do everything right and doesn't get the appreciation he wants, and the fuck up younger brother who everybody loves, right? Like and when you write a stiff character and you cast kind of a blank actor, you lose the pathos and the struggle of that stiff character of feeling jealous and feeling, you know, overlooked and angry and self-loathing and all of that. He just was what was on the box. He was just stiff older brother who's doing a good job. And we never got into the interesting stuff about being in that position that I think would have made the movie much more relatable.
I thoroughly agree. I also do wonder, and this is something that I kind of am surprised that this never came up before in the 5 years of our 99 podcast, or quite frankly, in any of the episodes that we've done, in terms of the trope of strict religious parents. I think that permeates a lot of films.
Sure.
That tends to be sort of a hallmark of either a character embracing said ideology or bucking said ideology and becoming, you know, whatever the case might be. I find it incredibly trite and always very boring to watch because I find it very irrational. It always feels very binary to me the way that it's written. You know, the strict religious parents always feel so, you know, I don't even really know what the right word is, but just sort of, they don't feel realistic to me. Now, again, I was not raised in a religious household. I imagine that if Emily was on this episode with us, she would have thoughts on it to some degree. I asked her yesterday when I saw her what her thoughts were on this film. And ultimately, she was like, I saw it a really long time ago. I remember seeing it. You know, Emily was raised in a very sort of strict religious household. And I think that to some degree that probably resonated with her. But for the most part, she was just sort of like, I remember not really liking it very much and just kind of moving on with my life, which is why I sort of feel like this film has sort of two big kind of signpost problems for me. And I imagine for you as well, which is, I don't really care about religious fundamentalism to sure. some degree. Like I don't live my life in a religious way. There are all sorts of stories that take place in that universe that can be interesting that I have seen. This just doesn't happen to be one of them. I also could not give a shit about fly fishing. So what you're left with really is not a lot to work with. Let me give a little bit of context just for our listeners who haven't seen this film. The McLean brothers, Paul, played by Brad Pitt, and Norman, played by Greg Sheffer, live a relatively idyllic life in rural Montana, spending much of their time fly fishing. The sons of a minister, played by Tom Skerritt, the boys eventually part company when Norman moves east to attend college, leaving his rebellious brother to find trouble back home. When Norman finally returns, the siblings resume their fishing outings and assess both where they've been and where they're going. Does that not sound really exciting, guys?
That's a hell of a plot right there.
River Runs Through It opened on October 9th, 1992, against Under Siege, The Last of the Mohicans, Sneakers, and The Mighty Ducks. Sneakers, obviously, a film that was starring Robert Redford.
Yeah, it's funny. And he opened against himself.
He kind of opened against himself. And a superior film. It would go on to make $66 million. It's pretty healthy on a $12 million budget. It has 80% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 83% from audiences. It won the Academy Award for Best Cinematography, and it was nominated for Best Musical Original Score and Adapted Screenplay, if you can believe that. Roger Ebert gave the film 3.5 out of 4 stars and said, fly fishing stands for life in this movie. If you can learn to do it correctly, to read the river and the fish and yourself, and to do what needs to be done without one wasted motion, you will have attained some of the grace and economy needed to live a good life. If you can do it and understand that the river, the fish, and the whole world are God's gifts to use wisely, you will have gone the rest of your day. Redford and his writer, Richard Friedenberg, exactly. Jessica's face is perfect. Understand that most of the events in any life are accidental or arbitrary, especially the crucial ones, and we can exercise little conscious control over our destinies. Instead, they understand that the Reverend McLean's lessons were about how to behave, no matter what life brings, about how to wade into the unpredictable stream and deal with whatever happens with grace, courage, and honesty. It's the film's best achievement that it communicates that message with such feeling. I mean, sure, that all sounds nice.
I don't think that happened in the movie that we watched. But again, I feel like this is another white dad projecting his thoughts onto a kind of a blank page. Like, that sounds like a very interesting movie. I wish that had been the movie.
It is interesting because I do feel like there is a grace to the pastor father's character. Right? He doesn't seem stern to be a dick as it has been sort of portrayed in movies like, I don't know, Footloose, for instance.
Sure.
You know, where you've sort of got this like dad that's hitting you on the hand with a ruler all the time. It doesn't feel that way. And I do think Tom Skerritt is very good in the film.
I always love him. Just always.
Yeah,
he has such a very quiet presence. I just find him enjoyable on screen whenever he shows up.
Totally agree. And he's good in this. And he has notoriously said this is his favorite film that he's ever made. And this man made Alien. So, you know, take that for what it's
worth. Contact. Yeah.
And Contact. And Top Gun. So, you know, he clearly cares very much about, he's bringing that heart and that sort of beauty, if you will, to the role. I just don't know that there's a lot of there.
Yeah, I think that, like, again, it's like the religious, as you're talking about it, the religious aspect could have been a really interesting part of this film because, you know, there is the question, in dealing with, you know, people that have addiction struggles, which is really what this movie is about. Like, why does religion fail to address that too? But that never gets brought up. The religion, it's interesting you were talking about this as a religious film. And my father is a Catholic deacon, but a very liberal Catholic deacon. And so I was raised in a very unusual religious household. And like, the religion in this film seems incidental. It seems much more about who Tom Skerritt is as a person. Like, he didn't have to be a preacher. He could have just been a dad who believed in unconditional love, but was kind of stern. And I don't find that the pressure of the religious aspect added much to the story. Didn't seem to add much pressure to what the boys were going through. There's, I think the very best thing in this film is the way they show Jesse's family dealing with her alcoholic brother. And it's this situation, they're a much more liberal family. They're all drinking. They're all very boisterous compared to the McLean family. But they also have this big thing they don't talk about outright, which is that they have this family member who's a really messed up alcoholic and having real problems. And it's clearly this huge trauma they're trying to compensate. And then you have the McLean family that is very puritanistic and you know, plain and modest. There's even a line in there about like, oh, he's Presbyterian. I think like that's why he doesn't like our family or whatever. But they are dealing with it in the same way, which is by not talking about it. Like, that contrast between the two alcoholic brothers is kind of where this movie almost feels like The Great Gatsby or something else of that period, where mm-hmm. it's like, we're talking about issues by not talking about issues. And again, like, the religion could have factored into that really well, but it doesn't. It's not there in the movie. At some point, there is so much subtext that the story just falls asleep. And I think that's kind of where this ended up.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I could say that there was even a lot of subtext. I'm not, I mean, I absolutely agree with you that there's an interesting sort of juxtaposition going on between these two families. But I also feel like they kind of dropped the ball in the Neil stuff, which is Jesse's alcoholic brother.
Yeah.
Because you don't, there's like this mixture of Norman and Paul seem not just plain and boring, but also kind of like, dumb's the wrong word, but just like not astute to things in the world around them. So because they don't kind of outright say that Neil is an alcoholic until after this kind of weird situation where she tries to force Norman and Paul to take Neil fly fishing with them in the hopes of maybe they're sort of something will rub off on Neil from Paul and Norman in terms of like, you know, goodness and whatever. There's kind of this whole debacle where he brings a prostitute and gets drunk, and it's the only time that the film has any sort of like, I don't want to say life, but like something's happening.
Yeah, so there's a story occurring.
Yeah. And you know, Jesse yells at Norman and says like, how could you have left him alone? And I'm just like, he's a grown man. Like, what do you mean left him alone? Like, I don't see how that's even.
See, I found that interesting. I found that line. I don't think she was right to have that reaction at him, because how the hell was he supposed to know? But like, in the terms of like, when you are a family that has a traumatic secret that you're hiding, you forget that everybody else isn't part of the conspiracy to hide this. So it's easy to feel betrayed when someone is not in on the game. You know, I thought that was actually kind of interesting, but it's a ridiculous reaction because he doesn't know he's an alcoholic. But the real failure with that thing is like, Paul has no moment of introspection seeing how messed up Neil is. It doesn't occur to him at all. Like, he thinks it's funny. It's played off as a funny incident. And it's like, you're missing your own pitches. I don't understand.
It's weird because like there's this sort of Norman and Paul are the audience, for lack of a better way of putting it. Right. I mean, they're the main characters or the audience. And I feel like because they're so kind of unaware to some degree, I feel the same way.
Yeah.
Right. So in that argument, Norman doesn't really understand what the hell's going on. And then it isn't until later where, again, it should be said, at no point is it explicitly said that Norman is an alcoholic.
You mean Paul?
Sorry, Neil.
Neil and Paul.
So it's never explicitly said that Jesse never says Neil has an addiction problem. No. Neil is an alcoholic. Instead, she says, why is it that the people that need your help the most are unwilling to take it or something to that effect, right? And if I'm Norman, I have to read between the lines here and try to figure out what exactly Neil's problem is. But fundamentally, Norman and Paul don't like Neil. They don't like Neil because he's kind of a prick, and he hits a dog at one point. I'm like, that's a line too far, as far as I'm concerned. He just seems like a smug asshole, quite frankly. And these two, you know, middle of the road white bread guys, of course, look at this guy and they're just like, no, thank you. So we kind of have a similar perspective of Neil and this continued sort of read between the lines, subtextual, what have you, doesn't work for a movie that's this kind of vague on top of everything else.
I agree with you. There's such a lack of specificity of any, like even the fact that like, okay, Paul is a newspaper man and he's supposedly doing these controversial stories. We don't know about what, we don't know if that's why he gets killed. We don't know. Like we don't, it's so funny. There was a movie that came out recently that I will not smear because I feel bad doing it, where everything revolved around the character's jobs. But you never actually find out what they just have business job. You never find out really what their job is or what specifically like the point of it is or why they care so much. So it was like, why am I buying into this? And this was the same thing. It's like, that could be an interesting story is if, you know, Paul was really pushing the boundaries on journalism in this town and it was upsetting people, but it's like, but he's not, it has no consequence.
You know, as you were speaking, I'm starting to wonder about what the development process was like for this film.
Yeah.
And I say in the sense of clearly Norman was still alive when this film was being made. He appears at the end of the film.
Oh, is that really him? Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. It is very personal. My assumption is that Redford took it very seriously, but you also have to wonder whether or not there were things they weren't allowed to talk about, things that they couldn't dig deep into, you know, embellishments or things that might have made the film perhaps more filmic were resisted by Norman. I don't want to assume anything, but it does feel to me like there's a strictness to the material that perhaps was like handcuffs and really kind of gave them very little latitude.
Yeah. I was reading a little bit about the film and Brad Pitt said at some point that like he doesn't love the film because he thinks he could have done a better job, but he was very young and he doesn't think Redford pushed him far enough. And he said like, it was complicated by the fact that the family was still alive and they were sometimes on the set and that made it just a more difficult situation.
I mean, this is, you know, you could do an entire podcast on films based on real events and why they're not documentaries and why sometimes we need to find some wiggle room in there. And I think sometimes movies go too far. Sometimes they don't go far enough. It's a really weird kind of chemical equation when it comes to these types of movies. And this one really feels kind of smothered a little bit in terms of just, you know, stick to the words on the page, like don't kind of deviate from that. It's interesting. I also feel like, and I don't know if you knew anything about fly fishing going into this film, Jessica.
I did not, no.
I know as much about fly fishing now as I did when I pressed play on this movie. It's beautiful. And, you know, it won Best Cinematography for a reason.
It is gorgeous. The film is stunningly beautiful.
Beautiful to look at.
Yeah.
These sun-kissed river scenes and the way that they do the fly, like it is beautiful. I don't know what the fuck they're doing, though. That's the thing about it.
Just waving a pole back and forth. And I was like, that's how you catch. I feel like I know even less about fly fishing than I knew at the beginning of this film.
It's, I mean, and this is just, I'm just going to say what I think is supposedly happening, which is I think they're trying to actually draw the fish out of the water with these, with the bait or the tackle or whatever they've got on the end of the line, right? And I'm assuming that that's what's happening here. Because at the end, they say something about like the fish jumping out of the water or something to that effect. But like a perfect example, I think, of what you and I are talking about is near the end of the film, Norman and Paul are fishing together. Their father is there watching them fish. And we're seeing Paul, you know, be sort of this groundbreaking fisherman that he is in terms of, you know, whatever. And he looks over at sort of a quadrant of the river across from him. Mm-hmm. And the camera locks in on this spot of the river two, maybe three times. And in my head, I'm like, what am I looking at? Why is this important? How is this? And I still don't know. Like, clearly, it means something to fly fishermen, I'm assuming. But, like, to a fucking layman, you're just like, yeah, okay, there's some water.
I bet there's fish in there. I don't know. It does not do enough. It needs a smidgen more exposition about how the fuck fly fishing works for anyone who does not already. But, you know, from what I know about fishermen as a hobbyist fishermen as a breed, they don't want, they're kind of like magicians. Like, they don't, if you don't know, you don't deserve to know. And that movie kind of makes that point where it's like, if you're a good fly fisherman, you're good at life. Okay. I mean, I doubt the fish would agree.
Yeah. I'll say this, though. In terms of the fish, they did, apparently, there was something I read here about how they, so the trout used in the movie were pond-raised in Montana and were kept in specifically aerated and cooled tank truck into their big moment in front of the cameras. No hooks were used, no blood was drawn, a line was tied to each film's lower jaw under the careful observance of the Montana Humane Society. That's great. I'm happy to hear that they did that.
But did they ever act again? I mean, that was the end of their career.
Touche. I will say, though, kind of surprised they did this in 92. Like, in 92, I'm surprised they weren't just like fucking hooking fish.
Yeah,
like,
kill every, like, bring thousands of fish in. Yeah.
Who gives a shit? So Brad Pitt beat someone out for the role of Paul McLean, someone we have discussed on our double feature together, which is River Phoenix. He was up for the role. I don't know. I love River Phoenix, as we discussed on our episode of the Patreon. They have a similar energy at this time. I mean, obviously River isn't with us anymore, but they were both sort of like up and coming, charismatic, good looking guys who kind of really kind of the screen liked them. I wonder whether or not, I think Brad's the right choice when everything is said and done.
I agree.
But I also kind of would have liked to have seen what River would have done with it.
I mean,
not just because his name's in the title.
I would have liked to see what River did with any role. He was always interesting on screen. But I think the thing about Brad Pitt, that if this movie was what this movie was supposed to be about, which is a sibling rivalry, really, and a sibling relationship, I think Pitt is the better choice because there's something about Brad Pitt's beauty that I think intimidates men slightly. Like, he's so pretty, I think he makes men a little bit nervous. And I don't think River Phoenix quite had that. He was also very beautiful, but in a more accessible way. Like, and you need that. If you want a brother that is jealous of his beautiful, charismatic younger brother, you need that feeling of like, yeah, I kind of get it. I'd be slightly intimidated if this guy was my younger brother too. And I think Pitt's better at fulfilling that.
Yeah, I also think that Pitt is a little more timeless than River was.
Maybe,
a little bit. Like, don't get me wrong, River's incredible at the beginning of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, obviously. Like, he kind of fit in any time period. But he's in Sneakers with Redford in 92. And he's great in that movie.
Yeah.
There's a moment at the end of Sneakers, which we talked about in our episode, where at the end, he takes off his baseball cap and his hair is just like this crazy, like, mane of hair. And you're just like, this guy just doesn't fit in any boxes. And I think that I don't know that that might have been an asset in this movie, quite honestly, but it also might have broken in the wrong direction for this movie, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's hard. He was a subtle actor. So in this movie that really had nothing to play, I don't know. You kind of also need a greener actor who will go a little bigger with his choices, because at least Brad Pitt is a little more interesting to watch on the screen in this movie. Like you are interested when he's on screen. Mm-hmm. And that is not true for most of the rest of the cast, I would say.
I would agree with that. That is an accurate assessment. I want to talk, let's talk Brad Pitt for a second here, because this is one of his earlier leading roles.
Yeah.
He does Thelma and Louise in 91, and that's sort of a moment when everyone's like, who's this guy? It's his big break.
Yeah.
92, we did an episode on Cool World. A very strange movie that oh boy, someday Jessica, you should watch I would say like 15 minutes of Cool World.
Is that the one that's partially animated or something?
Correct.
Okay, yes.
But yes, it was sort of the Ralph Bakshi Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Okay, that's intriguing.
No one asked for.
Yeah.
It's intriguing, but just very upsetting. And Brad is. It's Brad Pitt, Kim Basinger, and Gabriel Byrne are the three leads in that film. And Brad being the greenest of them seems very over his skis. And that's not his fault. He's just, anyway. But in the same year, he does River and Source. So he's got both of these films. And then 93, he's got California and True Romance. 94 is his big year where he's got Interview with the Vampire, Legends of the Fall. And then 95 is Seven and 12 Monkeys.
Right.
So it's like there's a real ascension happening for him in the early 90s. And then he really gets sort of mired in kind of Oscar baity bullshit like Sleepers and The Devil's Own and 7 Years in Tibet and Meet Joe Black. And he's really a kind of a nadir after those four films. And then he's got Fight Club in 99. He gets obviously back in bed with Fincher. And it really isn't until Ocean's 11 in 2001 that I think he really, to kind of your earlier point, fully understands what people want from Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
And then from that point on, he's kind of given us Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
With a couple performances here and there that are a little bit outside the box. But for the most part, it does feel as though, and listen, I like Brad Pitt. I think he's a very watchable, fun actor.
I do too. You know, and there have always been actors that we like more for their presence and what they look like. And that doesn't mean they're bad actors. It just means that, like what you said, what we're looking for them is something very specific. And it's weird when they try to go too far out of the box. It feels false in a way we don't expect from, you know, like character actors, because it's like, we know who Brad Pitt is. So it's bizarre if he's suddenly trying to be someone wildly different, but it is sad in a way. It feels like at that point, a lot of artists stop developing and it's the same. So it's, you know, it's a double-edged sword. It is what I like seeing him. I love seeing him be, you know, the Brad Pitt that's in Ocean's 11. I love that. That's a really charismatic, funny character. But as an artist, I wonder how fulfilling that is.
I agree with you. And I do think that, you know, he tries to push back from time to time. If it's a Assassination of Jesse James or, you know, even to some degree, like, yeah, Benjamin Button is like, that's a crazy movie.
Yeah.
And he's doing you know what I mean? For good or bad, I think he's trying to do interesting stuff. And then I also think there are times when he weaponizes the Brad Pitt thing very smart. Like, I think I love Moneyball. And I think that is definitely one of his best performances, if not his best performance, in terms of understanding. It's just a full understanding of the persona mixed with this real person. I think Inglourious Basterds or, you know what I mean? Like he's done a lot of stuff. Like I kind of look at this filmography and I'm like, it's pretty impressive what he's, you know, the juice he's gotten out of what, if I look at a river runs through it.
Yeah. No, I mean, he's had a great career, and I think he's probably somebody that really enjoys being on set and enjoys sure. doing the whole movie business thing. But yeah, Redford was somewhat like this himself. Like, you wanted Robert Redford to be on screen to be funny, sexy, intellectual. Like, you would never cast him in a role that wasn't that. So I wonder if there was a camaraderie between the two of them.
For sure. I mean, they do Spy Game together many years later. But yeah, I mean, one of my favorite Brad Pitt stories, and forgive me if you've heard this before, but so Burn After Reading, the Coen Brothers mm-hmm. film that he's in, he'd never been in a Coen Brothers movie, and he read the script, and he said to them, "I don't think I can act this dumb." And they said, "Don't worry, you'll do great." Which I think was a way of saying, you're not as smart as you think you are.
Yeah.
But I think that there's, to your point, as time has progressed into Brad Pitt's career, I do feel as though there's a self-awareness that's happened, which I immediately give him points for, because, spoiler, most actors don't have self-awareness.
That is true.
I think that, listen, everyone in Hollywood is guilty of that in some form or another.
100%. So, you
know,
yeah.
It's not just actors, but I think that there's something interesting there. I think that the camaraderie or the connection between Redford and Pitt, I do think is an interesting one for sure.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you saw a little bit of a younger version of himself in Brad Pitt to some degree. Apparently William Hurt wanted to play the role of Paul McLean. Which
I can't really see. I can see him being Norman. I can't see him. That's somebody who definitely thinks he's a lot cooler than I think he is. But yes, that's William Hurt for you.
And then at one point, the film is considered as a vehicle for Lloyd Bridges and his two sons, Beau and Jeff.
Well, that was my thing about the guy that played Norman, is I was like, he's almost a Bridges. He's almost Tim Robbins, and he's almost a Bridges brother. Yeah. Almost.
Yeah. But I think that, like, I mean, listen, there's any number of reasons why that version didn't actually come to fruition, but I do feel like, and I don't know if it's because most audiences don't even know this stuff, right? Like, most audiences aren't even cognizant of the fact that, like, some brothers play brothers on or sisters on film, whatever the case might be.
Sure.
But I do think there's a connection there, whether you know, Fabulous Baker Boys is one of my favorite movies.
It's a great movie.
They don't look anything like brothers.
Yeah.
And yet, they are brothers. Like, you can tell that these two guys have known each other their entire lives. And I think that energy brought into this film, I think, would have been interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting too. The film starts out with Joseph Gordon-Levitt as a little baby. And you spend 20 minutes with the kids as kids. And actually, I thought that was the best section of the movie. Both of those kids are so compelling. They feel like brothers. Yeah. It's shot really beautifully and intimately between them. And then it's like Redford forgot he did that. And there's never that sense of brotherliness between the two of them again. It's an odd contrast.
Absolutely. It is an odd contrast. And, you know, to harken back to what you said, you know, at the beginning of the podcast, that, like, the lack of stakes and the lack of sort of really feeling any sort of threat to their way of life is just crushing to the movie, right? Like, it just, it takes all of the air out of it. I think about the riverboat waterfall sequence.
Yeah.
Early in the film, which, by the way, really well shot and really
so
well
gorgeous
done.
Yeah,
I was just like, this is crazy. I don't know, like, how did they do this?
Yeah.
And then, you know, you have this, like, are they gonna live, is everything gonna... and of course they live, but also just sort of like, okay, so that happened. Like, a lot of this movie just feels like scenes where you're like, and then that happened.
Yeah. Well, you know, and films about mundanity can be interesting. You know, I think of something like Lost in Translation, which is essentially a mundane film where not much happens, but it is if you're gonna make a film mundane, it's got to be about the fact that people still have the full human experience even when their lives are somewhat ordinary. And here it's just like, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened, and it's like, I can't tell if you feel anything about your own life.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
It feels very like you're kind of stuck at a family friend's house and they're kind of telling you a story. You know?
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, okay, so some stuff happened.
Yeah.
Like, it's what's also interesting too is that I feel as though you have this, and we'll get to the ending when we get to the end, but I do kind of feel as though they sort of pull the rug out from underneath you a little bit. And I think they think that that's effective, but it doesn't do what they think it's doing because you didn't lay the piping for any of it. So, like, you know, if you look at Paul's character, the Brad Pitt character, who, as you said, has interesting things about him, mm-hmm. or at least things that are filmic. He's a reporter. He apparently talks to the president. He does, you know, he reports on interesting things. He's a gambling junkie, apparently. You know, he plays poker. He's in debt up to his eyeballs. He drinks. He clearly is a womanizer to some degree or another. But all of this stuff is dialed so far down that it barely registers.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that is the whole problem. None of it affects anything that's happening in the film, and you can't tell really what anyone's reaction to it is. Like, I mean, again, that should be the stuff that drives his brother crazy, that his parents still love Paul while he is constantly getting into these problems. And it's just, but it doesn't, it's, that's just what he does. Like, that's just what happened. Whole like fascinating and completely unexplored scene where he brings a Native American woman as a date to a bar where she's clearly not welcome. And like, and then it ends with her being unconscious, drunk on the floor of the jail, and Norman just dragging her out like she's luggage. And then she's never mentioned again. And it's like, what the hell was that? What are we supposed to take from that?
It's funny you bring that up, because I was thinking about that scene as well, because I I don't want to like make any judgments or assume things, but I'm going to, because on some level, like, what else you can't help but feel like perhaps the real Norman didn't want to disparage the memory of his brother and didn't want there to be, you know, an account of his brother that didn't seem to some degree or another flattering. I think in the process of rounding off the edges, perhaps they flattened the character to such a degree that it became, you know, just kind of like whatever.
It may also just have been that as a writer, both the screenwriter and the novelist they had puzzle pieces and not a real idea of how to construct a puzzle. You know, he had like, well, this was an interesting time with my brother and this was a weird thing he did, but didn't know how to construct that into a narrative with a theme under it. Totally. And the script did not do that either. And that's really where if I had to critique this script at my day job, I would throw myself out a window. This, like, and I know it's Academy nominated, so who knows what the hell I know, but like it would be one of those scripts that just drives me crazy, because it's like, you're making me read this and I don't think you can tell me why I should be reading this, and you wrote it.
Well, yeah, no, that's fair. I'm pulling up the other nominees just because it's worth us talking about for a quick second here. We have Howard's End, okay. Enchanted April,
great movie.
Player, A River Runs Through It, and A Scent of a Woman.
What one?
I mean, Howard's End.
Okay.
Which is reasonable.
But man, was that a languid white people year at the Oscars? My God, that's a bunch of movies of people with no one with problems.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy that that Malcolm X wasn't nominated for the Baptist
Screenplay,
for instance. So, you know, yeah, it is one of those years where I kind of look at these films and I'm like, you know, I just recently went to see The Player again, played at the Arrow here. And I like The Player. We're going to do a whole episode on The Player, obviously, at some point. I have my issues with it. I don't think that it's a perfect movie by any means, but I think there's a lot of really, really good shit in mm-hmm. there. Have not read the book, so I can't speak to how well it was adapted or not. Scent of a Woman seems like it was loosely based on a novel of which I've never read, an Italian novel by a film. It seems, I'm just trying to look at what it was adapted. It was adapted from a novel and a film. I don't know how much Bo Goldman read or saw these films, but I have my issues with the screenplay for Scent of a Woman as well. It's literally called Scent of a Woman.
Yeah, there's that.
It's a whole thing. You know, I think that there are lots of films in 92 that I would have put in this category before these were the films that were nominated. And I'm a little surprised that A River Runs Through It gets in there.
Well, I don't know. It feels like the early 90s. And, you know, I was 10. So I don't have a super strong sense of what the film world was like at the time. But, like, it seems mm-hmm. like that was the era where we were at the height of these very highbrow period adaptations. You know, that feels like that was the Merchant Ivory height.
You're right.
What we were really looking at were these very intellectualized, beautiful films about white people having minor problems. So this seems like kind of the peak.
No, absolutely. You're absolutely right. Right. And I think that we, you know, as the 90s progress into more sort of as we veer away from adult movies, and I don't say that to say, like, I just mean movies aimed at adults. And as we start to segue more towards the four quadranty stuff that seems to sort of, you know, obviously becomes everything, I think that stuff gets pushed a little bit more to the side.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you start getting the younger filmmakers that were influenced by 70s filmmaking rather than 50s and 60s filmmaking. And things just start to get a little more unhinged, I think.
And more interesting.
Yeah, in a good way, in a positive way.
100%. I think that, you know, just looking at the other sort of nominees of this year in terms of just the, you know, original screenplay, for instance, we have The Crying Game, Husbands and Wives, Lorenzo's Oil, Passion Fish, and Unforgiven. The Crying Game wins.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Yeah.
We did a Crying Game episode, which it's a great episode and I think a fascinating kind of unpacking of a movie that I think is sort of unfairly put in a box.
It's a hard one to look back on. Like, it's 100%. So of its time, but it's hard to remember that it was still a big kind of step at the time.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things we talk about in the episode is sort of, you know, the choices that Neil Jordan made and why he wanted to sort of do this depiction and how, you know, progressive and quite frankly, bold it was to do at the time.
Yeah.
It was weaponized by none other than Harvey Weinstein to turn it into this kind of, you know, tongue wagging, crazy twist, even though it happens 45 minutes from the end of the film. So it's not even a twist, really. It's about a man grappling with love and attraction and all these sort of things. But, and then, you know, on top of that, a few years later, you have the, you know, the horrible, Ace Ventura nonsense. So it becomes this really gross thing that the movie doesn't really intend to be. The movie's weird in its own right. Like, and people should listen to our episode, but I say that this is a weird year for screenplays, period. Right.
Yes.
Like, you look at these 10 nominees and you're just like,
I would argue The Passion Fish is a better screenplay than The Crying Game. But as we all know, the Academy Awards tend to sort of, screenplay tends to be kind of a, here's a screenplay Oscar for a movie that we know we can't give anything else to.
Yes, this is true.
So
we are the consolation prize of Hollywood.
You know what I mean? So there is kind of that sometimes. But yeah, it's a weird year. Very strange.
Well, nationally, we were in kind of an identity. You know, the Cold War had ended. We didn't really know what the hell we were doing. Sure. We were trying to reformulate our identity. I'm not surprised. It feels like,
no, for sure,
a weird period of like, who are we right now?
Well, I mean, that's the thing that I think Emily and I have sort of been grappling with this mini series or with this series or what have you, is, and it's one of the reasons that I wanted to pick this year, which is you still have the hangover of the 80s.
Yeah.
And you still have these, you know, you have a lot of erotic movies, and Basic Instinct is making $400 million in the box office. Like, that's still very real. And then the next year you've got Jurassic Park, and that, you know, the sort of what that precludes to where sort of the rest of the decade goes in a lot of ways. But you're absolutely right. You know, you've got Clinton's about to win in November of 92. Yeah. So, you know, Clinton, for lack of a better way of putting it, is the next 8 years of the 90s.
Yeah.
And everything that comes with that, for good and for bad. But yeah, it is I think you're right when you say that, like, this is the kind of last gasp at a thing before a page is turned.
Yeah, I think it's really true. Yeah, and I think the Jurassic Park thing is really astute, because it's like, we became, the special effects became our identity kind of from that point forward. And I think also Toy Story was a big alteration in what we were aiming at. Mm-hmm. And yeah, but at this point it was still, I just think we were a little confused. We didn't know what we wanted to be.
I you know, you pinpointing technology, I think, is interesting too, because watching this film, which is so tactile, which is so in camera, right? This is the most kind of, you know, a period piece. You feel really, you know, in it. We talked obviously about Howard's End on a previous episode as well, which is a big movie in 92. Like, just, you had sort of period pieces, and this was a thing where adults went to the movies and they learned about history in some form or another. And then when technology comes into play, and anything, I put that in quotation marks, but basically anything becomes possible to render on a screen, from an imagination perspective, that's a game changer, right? Like, it's unbridled imagination, which is exciting to very imaginative filmmakers. But to the ones that are very sort of terrestrial and very grounded and want to tell stories about character, they get kind of left in the dust, and that's kind of where we are right now.
And heartbreakingly, you know, the thing about this film is that, like, this is the kind of movie I wish we still had. I wish we had $12 million movies that made $60 million. I wish there were adult dramas desperately. I feel like we have lost so much with the passing of films like this, and it's damn near impossible to get them made. You know, it's just tough. So, you know, it's not a great thing that there aren't movies like this, even though this is a fairly boring example of the genre. But I will say, though, I don't want to be too mean to this movie. I do think probably what Redford latched onto, and certainly what I latched onto, you know, watching this a couple of days after Matt Perry died, is this idea of that, like, there are some people that, like, you can't fix them. You can't necessarily help them. All you can do is love them. And, like, that's what you can do. You can love them. And, like, that is an astonishing message and a beautiful message to come out of this film. And I wish it worked a little better in the movie, but, like, that is something that's universal and resonant and gorgeous in this movie.
I absolutely agree with you. I mean, I don't mean to suggest that this film doesn't have the best of intentions. I think that it does. I think that it just gets kind of lost along the way. But I agree with you. I think that I wish that what you just said was, like, underlined more in this movie. I think that this movie lacks kind of the courage of its convictions.
Yeah.
And doesn't And again, this isn't necessarily something that Redford as a director is particularly adept at, but, you know, we talked a little bit about Quiz Show up top, but like, I think the reason I like Quiz Show as much as I do is because I feel as though it's a really good script. You know, Paul Attanasio did the script, mm-hmm. and it just feels very sharp. It's very sort of clear as to like what it's saying. You have characters say things. Like, I think that, you know, one of the things about Ordinary People is about sort of how people don't speak their emotions and how people don't talk, right? It's about sort of these, you know, bound up, you know, white people that just rich white people that just don't say how they feel, right? And the consequences of those actions. And in some ways, this movie is kind of that again, right? Which is, you're not actually saying how you feel. You're not actually expressing yourself. And there are consequences for those actions, even though, like, isn't it pretty to fly fish? It's kind of
weird. Yeah, it's interesting. Redford, as a... It is interesting, his perspective on the white experience as a people, sure. because you haven't seen The Longer Bean Field War, but I highly encourage you to, because that is told, that's the story of, I think it's based on a true story, and it was also based on a book, but a white land developer is coming mm-hmm. into a village of mostly Native people and Mexican people, like Mesoamerican people, sure. and trying to take their water rights. And so much of that movie is just these people in this village being like, these fucking white people. Like, and, you know, Redford really had this idea of like how stupid we are, how repressive our culture is, and how bad it is for us, and how it makes us inhuman in how we treat other people. He had that concept in his head.
Yeah.
And but here it's like he fell into it. Here he just forgot that from the outside, these guys' story is not interesting. It's not deep. It's not impressive. But it doesn't have any stakes. They're just brothers kind of having a life.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think about the artistic component of this film. And by that, I mean Paul and this sort of, the way he breaks free of his father's instruction when it sort of creates his own rhythm of fly fishing,
mm-hmm.
And how I think that as an artist, I do think that probably Redford saw kind of this fly fishing as a metaphor in some way or another for, you know, artistic expression. I think that, you know, there's that line that Norman says where he says, "I realized while I was away, my brother had become an artist." I think that this is all really lovely. Now, it's about fly fishing here, people. So it is very hard to really give, you know what I mean? To really give that much gravity to this. But like, these brothers don't even hug.
No.
These brothers like shake hands very firmly. You're just like, how much can I care about two people that can't even like find a way to hug each other? It's just tough.
Well, and that, again, like the I think the thing with shaving down the edges of the father too much is that like when he tells Paul at the end, like, you've become a fine fisherman after seeing him use this technique that only he uses. Sure. Like, that could be really impactful if we had seen him being judgmental of his son at any point, or Paul struggling against the fact that he knows he's failing his father's expectations. But he doesn't. They love that he's a newspaper man. They want to hear all his stories. They want to spend time with him. Like, he has nothing to struggle against. There's no reason he's this messed up. None.
No one struggles. I mean, Norman struggles to get the attention of Jesse, I guess, to some degree.
Sure, but she's not a person. So who, like,
no,
yeah.
No. It's really tough. We don't even see them kiss.
Nope. And she doesn't show up till an hour into the movie almost.
And disappears
no,
also.
Yeah, there's no story for the first hour of this film.
Yeah, it's rough. It's because like there is, you do see as you're watching it, because like there's a lot of love on the screen.
Yes.
Right. I mean, I love all the sepia tone tin type photographs to kind of punctuate the passing of time. All that stuff was, I actually thought was really well rendered in terms of like putting the characters inside those time periods. The movie just needs like a kick in the ass is really ultimately what it needs. And it's just really kind of very content to just plod along and be a thing.
But listen, $66 million, and that's like 150
Oscar nominations. I mean, what the hell do we know? We don't have those things.
There are moments, though, and I know we've kind of said white a lot of times, but I do think it's worth kind of unpacking for a quick second here that this movie is sort of the moment that really hit me kind of was there's this picnic at one point.
Yeah.
Where I'm just like, this is some serious white shit.
They're in the middle of Montana, like on a riverbank, and there's like a little band and flappers, and it's just like, it's amazing, because I think in the hands of a more aware filmmaker, if you're going to make this now, there would be an awareness of how imposing and weird this culture, excised East Coast culture being imposed on this beautiful natural landscape, how strange and alien that feels. But here it's just presented. That's just what they do.
It really is, you know, I was watching it thinking to myself, you know, I understand that back in 92 and in the years that preceded it, that there was no one really keeping Hollywood's feet to the fire of really trying to show the full experience.
Certainly nobody who was getting through. Yeah.
Right. Some would argue still not nearly, and we are not nearly far enough to, you know, along, but at least now there's a real kind of, there's a pressure. There's a desire to be able to show the breadth of the human experience in every story that you tell, or at least to attempt it. There's no attempt here. And I think that not only was that okay, I imagine it was applauded. And that's a problem.
I think he was doing about the most that anybody did at the time, because there is the scene where he brings the Native American woman to the bar. And then there's also a scene where the mother is on the phone talking about how she wants to undertake this charity initiative with the reservation. Yeah. And, you know, again, like in the hands of a more fully aware filmmaker, you ask, like, should these fucking white people even be here? Who did they kick out of this land? Why is there a reservation there? Why did they, you know, who did they take this from? And those people are completely invisible in the film, and it's not discussed. But I can't tell, was Redford trying to imply that he understood some of that imposition on the world that these people are putting there? Because otherwise, why is that stuff in there at all? Or was he just thinking that of a normal fact of life that sometimes nice Christian ladies did outreach to reservations, you know?
I mean, for all we know, it's a vestige of some of a storyline that might have been cut from the film.
That's true.
It's certainly possible. You know, Redford does seem like a very aware person of
very
of
much
now,
yeah,
right, and even then. So it does seem strange on some level, for especially considering where this film takes place and you know, the various sort of regions of this country that were this entire country was taken from the Native Americans, but you understand my point.
Different
regions where it's more prominent, and there's a whole story there, right? Like, I want to see that movie. I think that movie is one that obviously should be told, but yeah, it is interesting. It's hard. Your depiction of the scene when he takes the Native American woman to the bar is just sort of like, you're just like, yeah, how? So it starts from a place of, you know, a white person patting himself on the back for getting his, you know, his girl to come into this bar. Or
whatever.
This kind of white savior kind of moment that exists, which isn't in its own way kind of gross, but much more endemic of 1992.
Sure.
To her being passed out on the floor of a jail cell and being dragged out like luggage. You're just sort of like, what are we even saying here? Like, what's the message?
Right. Because certainly from a 2023 perspective, that scene feels tremendously exploitive. Like, the white guys are in no danger. She is in an incredible amount of danger, and the film doesn't acknowledge it at all. And then it treats her like an inconvenient object. And it's just like, Robert, what the hell are you saying?
The only bit of that whole sort of sequence or swath of the film that I found endearing to some degree was Jesse talking about her hair and being, because she's like, she's like, you have the most beautiful hair, and she talks about like cutting it into a bob or whatever. What I appreciated about that was, A, it felt very human. It made me like Jesse. It made me like her for trying to sort of, you know, not just pull this girl into the conversation, but also, you know,
it made the scene very human to me, which I appreciated. Yeah. But it's a blip, and then on to other things. It's just it's very strange. I mean, the female characters in this film leave me wanting.
That's one way to put it. Yeah.
You've got Jesse. You've got this Native American character who, unfortunately, I don't know if I'm sure her name was said.
Mabel, I think her name is Mabel.
Mabel, you're right. That her name is Mabel. And then we have Rawhide.
Yeah.
So Rawhide is this prostitute character.
Yeah, she seems like she is out of an entirely different movie.
One that might be more interesting than the one we were watching.
Yeah.
There is a sort of this almost Calamity Jane from Deadwood kind of vibe that she's got. Not that Calamity Jane is a prostitute, but like there's this kind of, they meet her at a bar. We hear this narration again, explaining who she is. And then we see her again when she shows up with Neil fishing after, you know, they've tied on a lot of drinks and what have you. Not really sure what to tell you about Rawhide other than the fact that she's kind of shoehorned into this movie.
It's just a lot of things that are there. It is just so interesting because watching this film, it looks like you are watching a relic from this very recent and not totally gone time where the only perspective that mattered was white men's. And everything else was just an accessory, an obstacle, or a prize. And it's depressing as hell that was, you know, that was in our lifetimes. That was what that was the kind of film we were exposed to growing up as great art. And like that, oh, it's tough. Like I respect Redford as a filmmaker, and I don't think he's necessarily a misogynist or anything like that, but you see the unconscious misogyny that goes into scripts like this. And it's just like, yeah, I don't know what to say, man.
Yeah. And it does seem like there's kind of these moments where they're trying to infuse Jesse with a little bit of sort of anti-establishmentarianism, a little bit of like bucking back, or that she's a spark plug at the very least. Like you've got this one scene where she's driving them home,
yeah,
and decides to drive on the train tracks as a shortcut, and they drive through a tunnel and there's no lights, and there's this kind of like tension as to will the train, you know, crash into them. And then they're driving over the tracks and he's looking down at sort of the river below, and there's like a totally different way to direct that scene to give it kind of the juice that I think he thinks he's bringing to this moment, this kind of this lull in the movie. But the score is bizarre.
Yeah.
The score is like that. I don't even know how to describe it. It's like, it's playful and cutesy.
It's jaunty. Yeah.
Jaunty. Yeah. Where it doesn't feel like it has any real, that there's any real, as we said, stakes or doom or anything, you know. And it's shot in such a way that's not very dynamic.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, I don't know why you're doing this.
Well, and what is the consequence of that scene? And there should be consequence. Yeah. That's something that she's doing that Paul would absolutely find a hoot. Why is Norman okay with this in his girlfriend, but not in his brother? That's an interesting question that somebody should. It's just like a connect the dots image with none of the dots connected.
Yeah. And you're watching it. And as I was watching it, I'm just like, it's expensive to make a sequence. Yes,
very. I wonder if they didn't have enough money to pull that sequence off, and that's why it looked flat.
Fair. That's fair.
But yeah, the score is unforgivable in that scene.
The score is,
the Oscar-winning score, right?
Nominated.
Oscar just nominated.
So I want to talk about, I guess what you would argue is not the climax of the movie necessarily, but an emotional kind of climax, if you will, which is there's this moment where Norman goes to Paul and tells him that he's going to propose to Jesse, and Paul wants his luck to rub off on him. So he kind of drags him to this speakeasy where there's poker being played. And
It's so interesting because in the Wikipedia synopses, it says Paul tries to get in on a poker game in the back room, but the dealer will not let him play because he already owes so much money. That's not actually like delineated in the scene.
No.
Like it's crazy to me that there are so many like just necessary details of exposition that are just not in this.
I was so checked out of the movie by that point, but yes, it is not, I don't know what's happening in that scene. I really don't.
So if it was not for the Wikipedia page, I would not have known that that was supposed to be my takeaway from that scene.
Yeah.
But that being said, Paul tells Norman that he isn't leaving since he feels lucky. He's going to convince them to let him play, blah, blah, blah. So there's this scene outside this establishment where Brad Pitt's just smiling and acting cute and saying, I'm going to get it. It's going to be fine. I'm going to get in there, whatever. And I don't want to blame Brad for this because I really agree with you that like the writing and the direction is the people to blame here.
Yeah.
But the lack of depth and understanding in Pitt's performance and in this character just leaves him so unmoored that these seismic scenes feel completely devoid. Like they're just so totally flat.
Well, and immediately following this, like if he turned up dead, sorry, spoilers, the next morning, I get it.
Thank you. Yes.
But he doesn't. He's fine. He dies later for mysterious reasons.
Right. So like you have this scene where, again, we're supposed to be worried for Paul's well-being,
yes,
right? In theory, if this information was told to us that he was in debt up to his eyeballs and that he was fucked over,
yeah,
you know, whatever, then the tension that I think Redford thinks we're feeling the next morning when Norman is relieved to have Paul show up at the breakfast table, but like we don't... What? We don't feel any of that because we don't know that there's actually anything at stake here.
Yeah.
So well, then they go. Yeah.
The threat is never delineated. I don't know who's mad at Paul or why or if it's a real threat or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I guess there is a kind of interesting idea in this that Ebert got into in his review, which is this idea that like we don't know what moments in our life are consequential.
Yeah.
And like, so in that realm, it sort of makes sense that like he turned up fine after this thing that Norman was worried was dangerous. But then a few weeks later or months later, we have no idea. But sometime later, he got killed because like it might not happen tonight, but it could happen sometime, I guess. But that's not dramatic.
And also you and I have to work for that.
Yes.
Right? Like you and I have to sit here and like pulling teeth, extrapolate that from a film. That's a studio fucking Oscar movie. Like this should be, we should be, I hate to say this, but like we should be spoon fed this information. This is information that in order for this film to really connect has to have these signposts.
It is incredible.
Again, screenwriting 101.
Right. It is incredible to look back at this and be like, man, they just let people just make movies. Like I know we all think studios are way too overbearing now and they definitely have overcorrected, but like they just used to hand $12 million out willy-nilly.
Crazy. So then they go fishing. As you know, we mentioned, he catches a big fish. And it's a big win. And his dad tells him he's a good fisherman. And there's all this whatever. And it's a good sequence. I do think that ultimately it kind of sums up the whole movie in terms of like what the movie's trying to say. And it's very well executed. And it is a very big fish. I mean, it's an impressive fish.
They definitely chose the right size of fish.
They chose the right fish. I hope that fish worked.
That may be the best setup thing in the movie because we've seen other fish and they've all been smaller.
It's true. It's true. Jessica's speaking the truth, guys. We did see fish and they were smaller.
Yes.
And then basically we cut to Norman. It's a wide shot of the police station from very far away.
Yes.
And we see Norman walk out. We have VO that he was called to the police station. And that he was informed that Paul was beaten to death. He then informs his parents of this. Now, I say this in terms of to give our audience the aesthetics, because it could not be more emotionally devoid.
Yes.
It could not be less powerful. Now, this could all be intentional, by the way. I mean, I don't mean to suggest that Robert Redford doesn't have intent. I think he does. But the fact that I don't get to see the moment that his brother is told this, get to see his face, get to see how this actually resonates on his face. We get it broken to the parents. The scene is completely bloodless. It feels like there's no... They seem surprised. They seem sad, but also so buttoned up with their emotions. Yeah. The mom just goes upstairs, like just doesn't even like want to engage in this. And Tom Skerritt says, "Is there any other information you can tell me?" And yeah. He says that all the bones were broken in his right hand. I don't know what I'm supposed to take away from that.
I mean, I was guessing that meant that it was a fight, that he was punching someone, but we don't. It was interesting. When I was watching that scene, I was comparing it in my head. I recently watched Brokeback Mountain, and the scene where Heath Ledger's character finds out that Jake Gyllenhaal is dead is also told in a kind of mechanical way by his wife. And Ledger doesn't do a big emotional reaction because his whole character in that sure. film is completely stone-faced and incredibly bottled up. And it is such an effective scene. It is so emotional without big emotion. You know, you didn't have to take this scene into melodrama.
Sure.
But it was like Redford didn't trust the actor to be able to pull this off.
I mean, that certainly
for himself to be able to direct it, possibly, because it's right. just completely avoided.
Well, the Brokeback comparison is a really interesting one because I think that, I mean, two things come to mind. The first is we get a pop flash
yeah.
of Jack Twist getting beaten up.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a little bit of context to know that, oh my God, why am I drawing a blank on Heath Ledger's character's name?
Ennis.
Either assumes that he's being lied to in terms of how Jack actually died, or at least we as an audience are being privy to what really happened.
Yeah.
Or it's Ennis imagining what happened. Beside the point, we are seeing some sort of a depiction of what transpired. And then obviously it's him hugging the shirt at yeah. the end and, you know, seeing that release, that catharsis to some degree. We don't get any of that in this, right?
No.
Like we don't get a pop flash to a fight. We don't get, you know, some, you know, bookie beating him up and saying, you owe us money. Like
no.
nothing like that. And we don't get the catharsis.
Yeah, we don't even see the actor's face. Like it feels yeah. like from that moment, the entire rest of the movie is shot in profile. Like we get nothing. And so it's meaningless.
Pretty crazy.
Yeah.
And again, like on some level, just for argument's sake, since you and I are sitting here having this conversation, if this is Redford's intent, it's bold. Right?
What is the, like, what? I can't figure out what the intent is. It could be his intent, yeah. but I have no idea what he was intending, if that's the case.
Yeah, it's, you know, what's interesting is that I think that, It's sort of like the film is stuck in between two poles, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You have sort of this kind of impressionistic, almost Terrence Malick-y version of this movie.
Yeah.
Or you have the straight up Oscar bait, hand-holdy
Cider House Rules-y. Yeah.
Whatever it is. And this movie is stuck in between these two things, and it's kind of neither fish nor fowl. and I think that like the Terrence Malick version of this, I could probably get on board with, where it's a tone poem and it's more about sort of like the lyricism of
yeah.
fly fishing and God and it's all VO or it's mostly VO or whatever, like right, which is Terrence's thing, and God bless him for it. But it feels like there's a lack of commitment to that. And what we're left with is sort of this, like, what am I supposed to feel?
Yeah, no, I think you nailed it when you said, like, this is listening to somebody at a friend's house telling you a story. Cause like the effect of all of those scenes after his death is just like, well, sometimes things happen and you're like, great. That's not anything.
Whew. Well, you know what, Jessica? we went down the river together. I thank you so much for taking the time not to talk with me about it, not just to talk with me about it, but to actually sit down and watch this movie. A movie that I don't think you've ever texted me in all caps before, but I appreciated it.
I'm sorry.
I loved it.
I'm going to be forced through a 2-hour epic on fly fishing.
As you should. Just for our listeners, you texted me. I just want to read it because it was great. There it is. Oh my God, the whole climax is he catches a big fish in all caps with two question marks. Yeah, I mean, listen, no one should watch A River Runs Through It. I mean, unless you really want to.
If you're into fishing, maybe it works better.
Sure. And I also think, you know, there's two quick things I wanted to say. The first is you mentioned that you liked Brad in this movie.
Yes.
And I still think Brad hasn't really come into his own as an actor yet. And I think that he's not being given enough by Redford.
Yeah, I think that's true.
So what you're left with is a guy who still feels a little bit just uncomfortable, like a little stilted, a little uncomfortable in his skin, delivering lines in a way that I just sort of, that doesn't feel completely natural to me. It is an interesting performance to watch to see where he's come,
yeah, I think it only works for me in the context of Brad Pitt's whole career. Probably if I saw this movie in 92 and I wasn't 10 years old, like I would agree with you. But like the wobbliness of his performance makes him feel more real and more vulnerable as an actor to me. And I find that more intriguing than I find garden variety Brad Pitt.
That's totally fair. I think that is the right way to look at it. I think that he, and I think it's, you know, the next performance, him choosing California next, mm-hmm. where he plays this kind of, you know, serial killing kind of, you know, white trashy character. It's clear that he wants to get out from underneath this, but then he goes and does Legends of the Fall, which is just him being, you know, this beautiful, you know, long-haired cowboy.
Yeah.
All that being said, the only other person that I wanted to mention very briefly, I think she's got five lines, is Brenda Blethyn, who does play the mother in this movie. Brenda Blethyn, who is a great actor,
yes.
who would go on to get an Academy Award nomination for Secrets and Lies a few years later, is given truly nothing to do with
it. Absolutely nothing. She could be a cardboard cutout, and it sucks because I love her. She is such a vulnerable and sort of, she has a slightly unsettling quality to her that I
yes.
love.
Yes.
And it's just here, she's just puritanical mom.
Yeah.
No personality, nothing. It sucks.
I mean, truly not sure she says anything for an hour of this movie.
The things that female actors had to put up with in this era is just a travesty.
Yeah, it sucks. Very bad. Don't do it. So to rate this film, I know. I came into this podcast at a 68. I'm going down. I'm going to go down to like a 59. I don't think that this movie is like terrible. I don't think this movie is unwatchable. I found it, as we just discussed for the past 90 minutes, very boring. And you know, maybe watch it with your dad or your grandfather. It seems like something they'd probably really like.
They'd like it. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. This brings me all the way back to our very first movie together, which was Anna and the King, in terms of like, it commits the same two sins of a lack of directorial clarity, and it's boring. But also like Anna and the King, it's gorgeously shot. I mean, it's truly, truly beautiful on screen. I do like Brad Pitt in it. I would have to go somewhere around, I will be generous and give it like a 65, because I believe in the intellectual aims of it, and I believe in the thematics of it and the look of it. But man, did they drop the ball on kind of the things that make a movie a movie.
Absolutely. It's so funny you bring up Anna and the King, because if you put a gun to my head, I don't know which one I would recommend more. You know what I mean? Like, they both really suffer from sort of like cataclysmic decisions, mm-hmm. right? Like that really sort of render the film completely unengaging.
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, I can't sit here and say like
don't watch a movie with Jodie Foster and Chow Yun-fat, or
exactly.
don't watch a movie with Brad Pitt. And even from a subject matter perspective, right? Like, I think that Anna and the King has more to work with.
Sure.
But is also probably more offensive.
Yes.
I don't know, man. It's really kind of, it's a real Sophie's choice here. I don't know. I think they're both, but it is interesting that you bring it up because I do think they both kind of have similar foundational problems.
Well, there was one review that called this tasteful to a fault. And I think that's exactly the movie's problem.
That's a perfect review.
Yeah.
Yeah. It really is. Well, Jessica, where can people find you? I know you're still, I'm still on the terrible site that is
I'm avoiding Twitter as much as possible. My father actually called me in a panic this week because I hadn't posted in 4 days. And he was like, are you alive? Have you died?
Right. And you're like, no, I'm on Blue Sky.
He lives 5 blocks away from me. He could have come over and checked. I'm on Blue Sky at Baddest Mama Jamma. And the only thing I have to push right now is a campaign called Give Jessica a Writing Job. I'm bored
give Jessica
of
a writing
being
job,
of,
guys.
Out of work.
Yeah, I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
Give writers work, guys. That'd be great.
Please.
Twitter's a terrible place. I've found myself off it a lot more than I was, especially it will surprise nobody that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict doesn't bode well for social media when it comes to a nuanced take.
It is not bringing out our best, for sure.
It's a 5,000-year-old conflict that people have whittled down to tweets.
And memes.
And memes. It's not great. So I've really kind of stayed away from the... But you are still a wonderful presence on social media. You're also on Instagram, are you not?
Yes, I am. I just post pictures of baked goods on there. So if you're into that...
By the way, I mean, guys.
Yeah.
Baked goods.
Lots of baked goods.
But they should follow you and they should watch your film. Can people still watch
your
film? Yes,
you can watch my film, What Lies West. It's on Amazon. It's on YouTube. I think it's on Apple Plus. It's on a few places. Definitely watch it. Please watch it. It's a good film.
Well, there you go. Thank you so much, Jessica. You're the best.
Thank you.
Truly, thank you so much for coming on. And you'll be back.
I will be
else.
Back. I hope
It'll
I will be
exciting.
Back.
Yeah. That'll be great. All right, I'll talk to you soon.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.